You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the owner of a new cafe in Chippewa Falls is dishing out waffles and cranking out espresso shots for a bigger cause. Find out how she's using 100% of her profits to help families in her community. First, a new report released this week is again raising questions about conditions at the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake juvenile detention facilities. Staff working at the youth prisons have been under increased scrutiny as part of a deal for a class action lawsuit. But new details in the report point to dangerous staffing shortages and continued use of pepper spray and solitary confinement. Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, remind us what the restrictions were placed on Lincoln Hills as part of this class action lawsuit.
So there were a number of restrictions placed on the facilities when this class action lawsuit led to this agreement kind of in the middle of last year. Some of those requirements include limiting solitary confinement to 7 days or less, making sure that the cells in which the inmates are living are suicide resistant and protrusion free, making sure that the inmates have access to things like water, toilet facilities, hygiene supplies quickly and readily. And also things that certainly have gotten a lot of publicity in regards to Lincoln Hills, things like the use of pepper spray restraints, physical restraints on the inmates. It called for the facility to drastically reduce those methods of discipline.
We've got this new report now saying, yeah, it looks like the facilities are falling short on a lot of that. First of all, where does this report come from?
So this report comes from a court-appointed monitor. It's one individual that's been tasked with going into Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, doing interviews with staff and with inmates, reviewing all sorts of documentation, and then issuing these reports to essentially, update the court on how the facilities are doing and following these new guidelines and rules.
And the key findings, it sounds like, are that no, they're not meeting these obligations. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, as I read through the report, I think it was pretty common to see partial compliance or that there wasn't enough data. And so the court-appointed monitor said that she wants to work with Lincoln Hills for getting more data as the process goes along. There are some requirements that are tied to timeframes that haven't happened yet, benchmarks that we haven't hit. So 7 months down the road or 10 months down the road from when the requirements were put in place, we haven't gotten there yet. So this is certainly something that we're going to see again, you know, another report, another kind of check-in with the facility. But as of right now, they're certainly not fully meeting a lot of these requirements.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about the latest at Lincoln Hills Juvenile Facility and conditions there after a class action lawsuit last year. Laurel, the report points toward a fundamental problem, still staffing shortages at the facilities.
Mm-hmm. And the court-appointed monitor said that the staffing shortages really contribute to dangerous conditions at Lincoln Hills for a variety of reasons. The requirements for the facility include things like checks on inmates every 30 minutes, speedy responses. Some of the inmates don't have toilet facilities in their rooms, so they have to hit a call button to be released from their room so they can get access to those facilities. In the interview and in the monitor's reports, she said some inmates reported waiting quite a long time before they were able to get out of their cells to use the facilities. Some said that they were forced to use the trash cans in their rooms rather than being able to get to the toilets. And that's kind of a link with the staffing shortages that they're having. They're saying that there aren't people to perform some of these tasks expeditiously. Just to give you kind of a snapshot of what staffing is like there right now, their vacancy rates for things like youth counselors, they've got a 48% vacancy rate for counselors. They've got a 25% vacancy rate for teachers. So this is something that they're certainly working on. And the court-appointed monitor actually talked about some recommendations that Lincoln Hills was given for advertising these positions, maybe framing them a little bit differently to job seekers, offering sign-on bonuses or different financial incentives to get workers into the facility and meeting some of the needs of these inmates.
Ultimately, though, this facility won't be what it is anymore, right? There's this big plan to shift from Lincoln Hills to a bunch of smaller facilities. What is the progress on that?
So state lawmakers last year passed a plan that would close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake by 2021. So the state is certainly in the process of transitioning away from this Lincoln Hills type model. They're moving towards smaller regional facilities that are located throughout the state. Proponents of that plan say, you know, the smaller facilities are better just environmentally for the inmates. They offer them more access to family members. They're closer to where the individual is from. But I spoke to advocates and some of the plaintiffs in this lawsuit after this report was filed, and they said, yes, we're pleased that we're moving toward that model in the state of Wisconsin, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't work on making Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake the best they can be while they continue to exist in the lead up to that transition in 2021.
Governor Evers toured Lincoln Hills last week. Here's a little bit of what he said about that visit. He was speaking this Monday at the Greater Milwaukee Committee.
Many of those young people that I talked to in Lincoln Hills, at some point in time, if they would have had that intervention, we would be in a much better place.
So what are we hearing about from Governor Evers about Lincoln Hills and, interventions to keep kids from being in a juvenile facility in the first place?
Mm-hmm. This was a big subject of Governor Evers' campaign. You know, he obviously made it a priority to visit during the first week after being sworn into office. And he said on social media, directly or immediately after he made this visit, there's a lot more to do in terms of, you know, both the facilities, but also things to do to keep youth out of these facilities, investing in education and community services. I think that's a lot of what advocates want is more community-based intervention so youth aren't ending up in facilities, even when Wisconsin transfers to these smaller, more regional facilities.
Have we heard anything from Lincoln Hills staff, administration, or the Department of Justice in response to this report we've been talking about?
You know, I don't know of a specific response off the top of my head, but I do know that the report said that all of those parties were very cooperative throughout the monitoring process, and that they're all working hand in hand to, continue this implementation of the court's requirements.
And I'm sorry, I should have said Department of Corrections, not Department of Justice.
Yeah. Right.
Laurel, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, WPR's state capitol reporter. She was with us to talk about a new report that shows troubling conditions at the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth prisons. Despite court mandated oversight, you can follow that story, read up on the past and present of those facilities over at WPR.org. Check out our news page there. Coming up, a new cafe in Chippewa Falls is donating 100% of its profits to a program helping to connect families struggling to find housing with job skills and reliable housing. They're using the power of waffles and espresso to help do that. Find out how coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we find out how eating waffles could help out your neighbor, but only if you eat them at a certain cafe in Chippewa Falls. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tale about a man and his ram.
All right, everyone, get ready. The Super Blood Wolf Moon is coming. While this sounds super creepy, it's actually just a close-up lunar eclipse that turns the moon red from the Earth's shadow. As people prepare to catch a glimpse of this phenomenon early next week, it got writer Chris Hardy reflecting on another type of spectacle, his very own full moon faux pas.
One of the early celestial treats of 2019 will be a series of three consecutive full supermoons in January, February, and March. A supermoon is a new or full moon that closely coincides with perigee, the moon's closest point to the Earth in its monthly orbit. Back on terra firma, I had a near supermoon event last year on my farm, just hours after a full moon in the sky. So with tongue firmly planted in cheek, I present this tale, I mean a T-A-L-E. The premise is true, and the names have not been changed to protect the guilty. That morning, my wife Sherry and I decided it was time to bring our ram back in with the ewes for breeding. We had separated Fergus and the Young Rams, which sounds like the name of a rock band, from the flock a couple of months ago. It was time to bring the stud into the flock so that we will have spring lambs. Fergus, a fully grown Scottish blackface ram with big curly horns, is generally pretty friendly and likes to be scratched under his chin. My plan was to scratch him, grab his horns, and drag him to the ewe barn. But Fergus was extremely wary and wouldn't come anywhere close to me, even with the lure of a pail of feed. Fergus was playing hard to get. I had to go to plan B, wait until Fergus got close and tackle him. Hardly a sophisticated strategy, but one that has nevertheless proven effective in the past. I poured out a little feed. I waited. Fergus came closer. I leapt. I should have waited for Fergus to get even closer. Instead of grabbing his horns, all I had was a couple of tufts of his fleece. Fergus did not take kindly to my attempt and with all of his might tried to pull away. I knew I had to hold on and bring him to the ground. I did hold on. My pants did not. My dungaree selection that day was an old pair of black sweatpants. The string to cinch the waistband is long gone, and the elastic is stretched and old, the perfect complement to the belly it surrounds. The old elastic gave way as Fergus dragged me. In the span of 10 feet and 1.4 seconds, the pants went from my waist to my knees. The only thing between my birthday suit and the cold November sky was my drawers, and I could feel those starting to slide. A couple more seconds of dragging, and there would have been a big white supermoon, as fullness would have lined up with perigee. That would have been both embarrassing and potentially painful. I didn't have time to worry about my lower regions because I had to gain the upper hand. Luckily, I did, bringing Fergus to the ground. In one less than graceful fell swoop, I grabbed his horns with one hand and pulled up my pants with the other. Sherry greeted my foibles with laughter, suggesting that the experience would make for a good column. How well she knows me. I dragged Fergus out of the pen, and the recalcitrant ram suddenly was eager to head toward the greener pastures of the ewe barn. He arrived with no further incident. In case you're wondering, the supermoons will be January 21st, February 19th, and March 21st, with the February date showing the closest supermoon of the year. Be sure to enjoy these celestial events. I plan to be safely tucked away in bed, holding up the waistband of my pajamas.
Chris Hardy is a writer based in Jackson County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook, and on Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, imagine sitting down to enjoy a warm, buttery waffle with some maple syrup, maybe some whipped cream, too. How could that experience get even better? Well, if you're eating at the right place, the money you hand over for the delicious breakfast could go to help a local family experiencing housing insecurity. Brenda Buxman is a registered nurse of 16 years, the creator of the Warm Hearts, Warm Homes Chippewa Valley Project. She just opened the Jewelstone Cafe and Waffle Bar last September. Brenda, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you.
Well, what first got you paying attention to the issue of homelessness in your area?
My daughters actually had a couple friends that went through some difficult times with homelessness, and just talking to their parents, I became more aware of how the problem really impacts, especially children. And I started doing some research, and I just was shocked to learn that any given year in the Eau Claire Area School District alone sees about 200 or more children that don't have what's considered permanent housing. And that really just opened my eyes to the problem that exists here in my own community. So, and then I looked further into the problem, and again, talking to families, a lot of the problem that causes the situation is that they don't have the resources that exist don't give them enough time to really get on their feet so they can establish permanent housing. So I thought I wanted to do something about that and make a difference.
And when people think about homelessness, they might picture an adult living on the street basically all the time or maybe in a shelter. You see it playing out a little differently, right? It could be families who maybe sometimes have a home, but they just don't have that long-term home security, right?
Right. A lot of the families find themselves in situations where they're crashing on a friend's couch or, you know, the children are sleeping on the floor of a relative. Any situation where the family does not have secure housing that they can call their own.
And you, in addition to the Waffles, which we'll get to in a minute, you are involved with a project called Warm Hearts, Warm Homes, Chippewa Valley. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Warm Hearts, Warm Homes. I started that organization. My goal is to provide rent-free housing to families while the parents attend college, either vocational school or at the university level, and move into a career of choice where they can become permanently financially independent and therefore hopefully permanently break the cycle of poverty.
That's huge. How long have you been doing that?
We're brand new. We just started it in September, so it's just taking off now.
And you're coming at this from a career being a registered nurse for, I think, over 15 years. Can you talk about how that background in healthcare maybe led you to be interested in this?
My background in healthcare just opened me up to a lot of different people of all ages, all situations in life, and just opening my eyes to a lot of the different problems that they have. And so combined with the healthcare experience that I have, I also graduated in social work. So putting those two careers together, that's kind of what I'm working on now. So.
And you've talked about families and how this can impact kids. Can you tell us a little more, the impact of an unstable housing situation, of on and off homelessness, how does that affect kids?
Any child really needs to have a sense of security, and when they don't have that, you know, the children are moved from situation to situation, sometimes sleeping in a car, sometimes sleeping on the floor at somebody's house. Just being able to give the children their own home just really makes a huge difference, someplace that they can call their own, and it makes the family units more cohesive and stronger. And I just think that that's huge to provide for the security of children.
Talking to Brenda Buxman, creator of Warm Hearts, Warm Homes, Chippewa Valley, talking about homelessness there. And Brenda, you opened this Jewelstone Cafe and Waffle Bar as part of this effort. Tell us about the cafe.
The cafe I started because that is my other passion is coffee. And so I just find a lot of joy in running the cafe, and my family runs it with me, especially on weekends. And we have started stuffed waffles. We have about 9 different types of waffles, and so far I've gotten nothing but positive comments. People just have really been enjoying the different flavors of waffles and the different coffee drinks we make.
And then the profits are going into your homelessness efforts, right?
Correct, yes. 100% of the profits are going toward Warm Hearts, Warm Homes, Chippewa Valley. And so the cafe serves as a fundraiser for that, to continually providing the rent-free housing for the families as they attend classes.
And this is still pretty new, but what's been the response in your community since the cafe opened?
Oh, very, very positive. Every weekend we're seeing more and more people coming, and I just couldn't be happier. I can't believe all the good comments we've gotten, people that are very positive and driven to see us succeed and to help us any way they can. I've had people even offer donations above and beyond just buying the meals and the coffee drinks. So I couldn't be happier on the commitment that I've seen Chippewa Valley residents have to help their neighbors.
Well, I'll say, looking at the menu for the cafe has us all hungry for waffles around the studio. I wanted to look at one in particular, just to focus on the food, the Jewelstone waffle. This is what, a triple-decker waffle? Do I have this right?
Yes. Yeah, that's kind of a competition we have. Nobody has been able to succeed at it yet. But there's three levels of waffles. It's got strawberries, chocolate chips, chocolate sauce, and whipped cream and bananas around the edge of it. And so it's very, very large. And if somebody can eat it in 30 minutes or less, they can get their picture and name on our walls. So, I haven't had anybody be able to do that by themselves. Usually it takes about three or four people.
So it's a team waffle, really.
Yes, a lot of people have had fun trying.
Now, I got to ask, before I let you go, Brenda, a lot of people, most of us, I think, might say, okay, oh, I see homelessness is a problem. I'll make a donation. I'll get involved in maybe some small way. You've really tackled it head on, wholeheartedly. Why? What is it that made you want to do this? Not just to be kind of involved on the outskirts, but to really devote a lot of your life to dealing with this.
Yes, I wanted to make a difference, and this is a situation that I saw that could make a huge difference. And just, combined with the experience that my children had, with their friends who went through these difficulties, it just really opened my heart to this is an area in that people have problems with that I really want to make a difference and I really want to work with and help.
Well, Brenda, thanks for joining us, and good luck with the cafe and all your efforts there.
Thank you.
Brenda Buxman is a registered nurse of 16 years and the creator of Warm Hearts, Warm Homes, Chippewa Valley. Last September, she opened the Jewelstone Cafe and Waffle Bar, where 100% of the profits go to support families experiencing housing insecurity. You can take a look at their Facebook page for more info at Jewelstone Cafe and Waffle Bar. Coming up, if you're a parent who finds the act of raising sticky, sugary children a little more work than just using your natural instincts, you're not alone. We'll find out how attitudes toward child raising have changed over the centuries, from lots of affection to no affection at all to rubbing kids with salt. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and her guest for a look at the latest efforts to pass a pre-existing conditions coverage bill here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 7 on the Ideas Network. Now, there's no shortage of advice on how to raise children, whether you're looking for that advice or not. But the likelihood of finding a chapter in one of the millions of parenting books out there today that reads how to recognize the newborn that is worth rearing is pretty slim. Our next guest is here to add some perspective on parenting tactics, past and present. She says we should take a lot of advice with a grain of salt, including the once common advice that newborns should be rubbed with salt. Jennifer Traeg is the author of many books, including Well Enough Alone and the editor of The Autobiographer's Handbook and Don't Forget to Write. Her latest book is called Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, you're a parent, and I'm a parent, and it sounds like you hit a point where I was at one point. There's so much advice out there. It just reaches the point of absurdity, all the different and mutually contradictory advice. Is that what started you on this path to writing this book?
It did. I was immediately in over my head, and my husband was too, and the skills from our previous lives, he's a professor, I'm a writer, didn't transfer at all. And so I started doing the only thing I know how to do, which is read the literature. And it didn't help. It was the literature's conflicting and crazy, and the farther back in history I got, the weirder it became.
Yeah, and a big key of your book here, and it's in the title, Act Natural, this idea that having a child, it's the most natural thing in the world. You're just going to instinctively know what to do. If that's the case, why do we have so much different advice out there?
Yeah. I really think that none of it is natural. There's nothing natural about being up at 3 a.m. cleaning up someone else's vomit. It's all very strange.
And you go back quite a ways, ancient Greece and Rome, among other places, very different attitudes toward newborns and children then, including, I'll start at kind of the darkest place in your book here, the idea of exposing children, deciding we didn't want this one, and they would just put it out in the woods or whatever.
Yeah, it was very common. The Romans expressed surprise that other cultures didn't expose children. The numbers, it looks like most family would expose at least one. And, you know, it was a time before birth control, and it was really the only way to control family size was to just kind of leave one out for someone else to adopt. Sometimes animals took them away. Sometimes they died.
And even if it didn't go as far as exposure, a lot of times in places throughout history, including pretty recently, this idea of parents being really affectionate toward their children and having this super close relationship with them, this wasn't something that was taken for granted, right?
No, not at all. I mean, parents really saw having children as their job, but raising them could be someone else's. They would outsource that to the help, to other family members, and they didn't have a lot of free time to, you know, snuggle with their babies.
Yeah, and there's a lot of guilt nowadays in, I don't have time to do all the child raising myself. I feel bad if I outsource it to relatives or daycare. That was really, you write, the norm through a lot of human history, maybe even prehistory.
Right. Evolutionary biologists think that's how we evolved, that once we started raising children cooperatively, having other babysitters pitch in whenever possible, we had enough brain space to develop language and develop as a culture and a species.
And before we move on from the ancient world, this rubbing the babies in salt thing, what was up with that?
It's extremely widespread. It's done all throughout the ancient world. It's in the Bible, and it was sort of good parenting 101. When the Bible mentions it, it is, you know, you were like a child whose parents didn't salt you, meaning you weren't raised right. And I think it had to do with, you know, sort of curing the skin. For a long time, there was an idea that babies wouldn't turn into humans, wouldn't take human form unless you actively helped them along the way. And salting and swaddling were part of that process.
Talking to Jennifer Traeg, her new book is called Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. I want to go a little more modern now, Jennifer. In the last couple hundred years in the United States and England, there have been a lot of books written, a lot of advice given to parents. Can you talk about just how that's changed over the years?
Yeah, it is. It's funny how much it changes just from generation to generation. And the things that I do with my kids, I know look crazy to my own parents. We've become much more safety-oriented, and that's really just in the last 40 years that we started using seatbelts and safety seats and gates on the stairs. Other generations had things that were much more important to them. Posture, which is something we don't think about at all. But other generations were obsessed with it. Diction, again, something we don't care about at all. And air quality. The Victorians were pretty crazy about it. Early 20th century also, to the extent that people would install these sort of chicken coop type crates outside their windows for their babies to nap in outside.
And at every stage, people are writing advice, giving advice, and everybody is 100% sure, it seems like, the advice givers anyway, that they're absolutely right.
Yeah, you never find an expert saying, I could be wrong. No.
And that, as a parent myself, you know, I would encounter things that said, okay, for the, do you go to your baby when they cry at night? And one thing said, yeah, go in right away. That's the surefire way. Then there's the whole school, like, don't go, let them cry it out. And I finally hit a book, I think it was the Columbia University Guide to Parenting. They listed both those arguments, said, yeah, if you come down somewhere in the middle, you're probably fine. How are parents supposed to sort out all of this, like, exact opposite advice that's out there?
Right. I think you just kind of have to tailor it to your kid and yourself. You know, we also, that's exactly what we struggled with, the fervorizing, and we weren't tough enough to actually let her cry it out, but at the same time, gosh, we wanted to sleep through the night. So we found kind of a middle path, and I think that's what most parents do, whether they admit it or not. They fudge a little until they find something that works for them.
another common theme that comes up in your writing is that, okay, we come up with a new way to raise kids, and pretty soon someone else comes along and says, ah, the way we've been raising kids, that's why these kids today are terrible. We're really looking for our child raising as an explanation for what we've gotten wrong as a society.
Right, exactly, exactly. The Spock glass is probably the best example. Dr. Spock really had nothing to do with the baby boomer generation being a little wilder than previous generations, but cultural critics said, you know, this generation got spocked when they should have been spanked. And in fact, he wasn't much more lax than previous generations of experts had been.
Now, you've got a chapter, and this is the one that I got to say I laughed out loud the most in, on the history of literature for kids, kids' books. The 19th century, this is horrible. Like, you could turn these kids' books into horror movies. Talk about some of the books you encountered.
Yeah, that was my favorite to research, and it was absolutely shocking to me. The body count in children's literature, especially 19th century children's literature, is astounding. Even in primers, just to teach reading, on every page, a kid dies. And I can't understand why, except I think the author of that particular series, who was the best-selling children's author of her day and was translated into every language, was incredibly famous. Her name is Favalee Mortimer. I think she may have been a little sadistic. But yeah, kids get bumped off left and right in her children's books.
Yeah, here's one to illustrate how the CH sound can have a hard, a K sound. Here's a couple of sentences. After a boy shoots his sister Emma, Emma fell down dead on the floor. Oh, what a melancholy event. What?
No.
So okay, I got that hard CH sound down.
Yep. It's a far away from Dick and Jane. Yeah.
So talk about how you see attitudes toward kids, the way we think of kids as, you know, a separate stage of life versus maybe little adults, changing as illustrated through ideas about child raising and books for kids and all the things you looked at.
Right. So there's some debate among historians whether childhood in itself is a recent invention. I think most people agree now that, you know, it is its own stage. It wasn't always treated that way, and it certainly wasn't broken down into all the categories we have now. The idea of a toddler and a tween and a teenager just didn't exist. You were a kid and then you were an adult. And even as a kid, you had a lot of the same responsibilities that an adult would, and you weren't treated much differently. Children's literature didn't exist, so you were read to what the adults were reading, and it was often highly inappropriate. And now we have separate food for kids, separate movies for kids, separate clothing for kids, and that just didn't exist before.
We're talking to Jennifer Traeg, author, editor, and memoirist. Her latest book is called Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, were there times when you questioned your own parenting decisions and methods? Did you read parenting guidebooks? How did your own upbringing influence how you raised your own kids? And have you seen parenting fads come and go through the years? Did you look back and think, what was I thinking? I've got a couple of those. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Jennifer Traeg about her latest book. It's called Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, did you feel like raising kids came naturally to you? Did you learn a lot from a particular book or maybe a relative, maybe your own parents? Have you seen big changes in the way kids are brought up from one generation to the next? If you're the grandparent, have you been scolded, oh no, we don't do that anymore, or vice versa? Do you find parent guidebooks helpful? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer, ironically, I'll ask if you have advice for parents after pouring through centuries of parental advice. What would you suggest to people given this glut of information?
My takeaway was really, you're doing fine. That, you know, unless things are really, really, really bad and abusive, barring the really horrible stuff, just being there, letting your kids know you love them, sort of a basic caretaking, feeding, that kind of thing, that's enough. That's great. You get an A+ for that. All the other programming is just extra, and if it wears you out, it's not worth it.
A big theme that you point out is, with all this advice, there's a lot of guilt put on parents and especially on moms. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to land on moms in particular. I think men are starting to get that now, too. I don't know if that's good or bad. It also didn't exist until maybe 150 years ago. Before, if something went wrong with your kids, the parents wouldn't be blamed. The devil might be blamed. A curse from a witch might be blamed. But the fact that you sent your kid to daycare would not be the reason your kid didn't turn out well. But that really changed, especially when Freud came along, and mothers absorbed a lot of that.
Let's go to a caller now. Sandy is with us in Black River Falls. Sandy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was just wondering, as a teacher and a parent, did you find through your research that kids are not, and parents don't want to make mistakes now? They have so many books that tell them how to do everything, and a lot of times I feel like the kids learn from their mistakes and parents learn from mistakes in parenting, and now people are scared to make those mistakes, and things are very different growing up. Like, I don't feel like my parents had any kind of manual to say, hey, you need to do this and do that. They did it once and it didn't work, or if I did something once it didn't work, I got in trouble from it, I learned from it, and your behavior changed.
Interesting, Sandy. Thanks for the call. Jennifer, what do you think?
From the historical record, I'm not really sure. I just know in my own house, and I definitely see that if they can't do it perfectly, they don't want to do it at all. And something my parents always said to me was, perfect is the enemy of good, and just trying to make it good, accepting when it doesn't, is the whole process. And I don't know if it's because of social media, because everything's documented, because everything's aspirational, that sort of increased the pressure. But I definitely see this idea with kids that things need to be perfect.
Sandy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Jennifer, speaking of social media, do you see us being more performative parents, I guess would be the word I'd use, that we want to, we're using the social media to display what wacky, zany, fun parents we are with our kids?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that's I'm always wondering, what am I doing with my kids that 20 years from now they're not going to believe, like, our parents who smoked in front of us all the time. And I think it's the screens and the social media. I think they will be shocked that we were posting their pictures without permission, that we were using our screens at the dinner table. I think we're still really finding our way with that, and I think there's going to be some pushback.
And resentment from our kids, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I think.
Well, I'll speak for my teenagers. They're already there.
Yeah, we have a no posting without permission rule.
Thanks a lot for that call, Sandy, at 800-642-1234. We're talking about parenting and the way parenting trends, fads, advice have changed over the years. Jennifer Traeg is with us. She's the author of the new book, Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. Jennifer, you write about some of the most famous advice givers, in some cases in ancient Greece, some more modern, being, in a lot of cases, men who had no kids of their own, in some cases didn't actually like kids.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding. So a lot of the early literature comes from monks who have just zero child-rearing experience, including a lot of the obstetrical advice. Is really, really not their area of expertise. And then later on, two of the early experts are John Locke and Rousseau. John Locke had no kids. Rousseau had, I think it was 5 or 6, and he gave every single one of them up to a foundling home. And yet they became sort of the leading experts in child-rearing of their age.
Yeah, why? Why would we turn to people in those situations, just, I guess, using their philosophy to guide us?
Right. I think if you're actually raising your own children, you don't have a lot of time to write philosophical treatises about the way to do it best. It does kind of show how desperate parents of previous generations were for advice, that they took it from sort of dubious sources.
Now, we've been talking about kind of professional advice givers, people who actually write a book, that sort of thing. You also talk in the book a little bit about unsolicited advice offered by lots of people once they find out, say, that someone they know is pregnant. What kind of things are we prone to do?
Yeah. So I actually looked up the etymology of advice and was not at all surprised to find out it originally meant judgment, and I think that's how we wield it a lot of the times, from the sort of backhanded compliments and backhanded questioning about, you know, are you planning to make your own baby food? Will you be homeschooling? I'm not sure why we do it, except maybe to make ourselves feel better about our own choices, because whatever you choose is so hard, you kind of have to back it up. You kind of have to really believe you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, do you see maybe a counter movement to start getting less judgy about everybody's parenting?
I haven't really seen it. Certainly, the internet has sort of fed a culture of judging and not super civil behavior. I'm hoping the next crop of parents will go a little easier on themselves and each other.
You know, another interesting point is I'll use the word a parent or parenting as a verb without thinking about it. That's actually surprisingly recent.
Yeah, I wasted several weeks of research just looking for the wrong term. It should have occurred to me, but I was looking for parenting. The term used until 1970 was child rearing. And when a child rearing expert in the 1970s wrote a book called How to Parent, using parenting as a verb, he had to explain what he meant. People had never used the word that before.
Did that reflect, now that's caught on, does that reflect a mindset shift? Does that mean we're thinking about the job of being a parent differently?
Yeah, I think before parent was a noun and now it's a verb and it's very active. We spend more time with our children than any previous generation in history, and we take it much more seriously and we spend a lot of time and energy doing it.
So do you think we're spending too much time and energy, not asking you to judge us, given that we're trying to be less judgy here, but do you think maybe we've taken it too far in that direction?
You know, only if you're not enjoying it. My kids and I definitely like a little time apart from each other. We have different hobbies. You know, they don't enjoy knitting, and I don't like playing tag, and a little time apart is good for us.
Right, and I've seen, actually I was just reading on Twitter, people talking about, I posted something about how I'm getting sick of playing tag and got this, being Twitter, angry, vitriolic response telling me, the person who's writing, that they're a horrible parent. It can be hard to even admit that you're not 100% gung-ho, full-time, on-the-clock parent.
No, and gosh, kids' games can be so boring.
Yeah, man. Candyland?
Oh, man, yeah. We've been playing a lot of Clue, and I'm done.
Clued out.
Yep.
So is there a kind of advice book you'd like to see out there? If you were to write a book of just advice, not a book about parental advice, what would you want it to be?
Well, you know, I think Dr. Spock still holds up really well. It is sort of the common sense book of baby and child care. And more than anything, he's reassuring parents that you're doing okay, you're doing okay. And I think that's really what most parents need to hear.
And the good news seems to be that, whatever fad, up to a certain point, I guess, whatever fad or whatever child-raising advice is currently in vogue, we still end up with kids, and they turn out, for the most part, pretty good, right?
Yep. Despite Saranis' advice to recognize the newborn that is worth rearing, the human race is still here.
We'll leave it there. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Jennifer Traeg, author of many books, including Well Enough Alone, editor of the Autobiographer's Handbook. She joined us today to talk about her new book. It's called Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. You can still share your thoughts, maybe your stories, email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR.